podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, and thanks for downloading this episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. Now, if you've been listening for a few years, you will know that in 2018, I did an interview with Jamie Roberts, which sadly never saw the light of day due to a technical fault, which I only found out on the night I was trying to edit it and publish the podcast. I finally got over that, and what's helped to get over it is we've got this episode, a good chat with Jamie Roberts at long last. So yeah, it's only been nearly 4 years in the making, but here we go. At last, we've got a chat with Jamie Roberts. So in this episode, we sit down with Ross Harries, who's been on the show a couple of times before. Of course, you will know him from Scrum 5 and also a fantastic author in his own right. He co-wrote the book with Jamie, or ghostwriter essentially. And yeah, started off by having a chat with Ross, and then Jamie joins us during the podcast as well, even though he's dashing around across Cardiff. Managed to find time for us and dialed in, which is absolutely fantastic. Now, autobiographies can often be something of a dull affair and not necessarily go into too much detail when it comes to the big issues, but it's safe to say that Centre Stage is not one of those books. Jamie's tackled a load of the big issues and created a lot of debate. Plenty of things in there that people haven't agreed with. There's stuff in there that I haven't agreed with as well. But it was great to have a chat with him and get those opinions and have a good old fashioned debate about Welsh rugby, something that obviously we love to do on this show. So yeah, if you get a chance, check out the book. It's called Centre Stage and it is available now. And yeah, once again, a big thanks to Jamie and to Ross for joining us. Right, on with the show.
Murray to Jamie Roberts. Oh, Roberts is going through now. It's done. It's dusted. Archive it. History made.
Welcome to a very special edition of the Attacking Scrum podcast. It is my great pleasure to welcome back, I suppose, almost friend of the show now, Ross. It's Ross Harries. How are you?
I'm very well, Jed. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah, great to have you on. We were chatting just beforehand about the book that you've written with Jamie Roberts, Centre Stage, Jamie's autobiography. And yeah, it's caused, it's caused a stir in a good way, because there's clearly plenty of stuff in there and the press have picked up on that. I suppose we'll start with that, really. How early on into the writing process did you realise there was going to be a lot to work with?
Well, we've spoken before, Jed, about, you know, the whole writing process, and when Jamie and I sat down to discuss the book, you know, we were both fairly clear that there's only any point doing a book if you had something to say. You know, if I knew that Jamie had a good story to tell, because we all kind of know the basics of his life and career, the fact he's combined rugby at the very top level with some pretty serious university studies, you know, training to become a medic at the same time he was representing Wales and the Lions. Not many people I've traveled that path. So I knew there was definitely, you know, the bare bones of a good story, but he's also a bright guy who's quite opinionated. So we kind of made this pledge very early on that, you know, there was no point doing a book unless he was going to put some of those opinions down on the page. And turns out, as you've said, you know, it's had a bit of traction in the press, because he's got fairly strident opinions on things like the 60 cap policy, on the, you know, stay in Wales to play for Wales, on regional rugby, not necessarily a return to the clubs and the old system of, you know, nine clubs or more than nine clubs. He just wants to see the existing regions rebranded so that they kind of harness the history, you know, is attached to them all. So yeah, a few of those things have been picked up, and, you know, the English press have latched onto certain stories like the Sam Burgess saga at the 2015 World Cup, which is understandably something that will pique the interest of their readers, and the Welsh press have probably latched on more to the 60 cap stuff and the more political stuff, which we all love talking about it. We kind of love and hate talking about it at the same time, don't we? But it never fails to generate column inches in this part of the world.
Yeah, the thing that we can't stop talking about, maybe. Yeah, sometimes it's love, sometimes it's hate. How well did you know Jamie before writing the book?
fairly well. You know, our careers have almost run in parallel. You know, my broadcasting career sort of began roughly when he was getting capped. In fact, it occurred to the both of us when we wrote the book that when he got selected for the Lions in 2009, a young impressionable BBC journalist was dispatched to his house to interview him when he was in the midst of a house party. And that journalist was me. So it kind of made us realize, actually, yeah, that was when I was kind of, I wasn't even in sport then, I was in news. But as a massive rugby fan, I kind of volunteered, I'll go and do it. And it was hilarious because he was 21 at the time and a student, and he was living in this house in Cardiff. And we were trying to do a kind of semi-serious interview on the steps of his house, and all of his student mates were just filing in with, you know, crates of beer and bottles of whiskey, and all of them already half cut, piling into his house to celebrate the fact he'd been selected for the Lions. So it was quite a memorable interview. But that was the moment we thought, actually, yeah, we've sort of known each other, you know, reasonably well since that point, because, you know, followed his career closely through the Grand Slams, the Lions tours and whatnot. So it was actually a fairly easy alliance when it came down to it, because there's already a bit of mutual trust there. But obviously I've got to know him a heck of a lot better over the last 12 months or so.
The interesting thing that you touched on there is, because obviously you say you're a big rugby fan, I think that's what I've always enjoyed the couple of chats that we've had beforehand, is, you know, obviously you've got your broadcast career, but it's, you know, you're very, very knowledgeable on the sport, and I think see it from the, you know, you can still see that fan is still alive in you, you know, even despite working in the industry for a long time. When you're writing a book like this, do you kind of reassess some of those moments that you've lived through as a fan and see them through a different lens?
Yeah, I think you do. You know, my wife always jokes that I'm nowhere near as passionate as I was when she first met me, because, you know, she could barely sit and watch a rugby match in my presence because I was so ludicrously passionate, and, you know, it would upset me for days afterwards if my team lost. And I guess being my profession to a degree has kind of got rid of some of that. I'm a little bit more level-headed, probably a bit more mature as well. So yeah, you're right. When you look at things then through the lens of history, I suppose, you do look at it from a different perspective, you know, not just from a fan's or a broadcaster's perspective, but you really need to get inside, in this case, Jamie's mind, to try and explore some of the emotions, or at least try and understand some of the emotions he'd have been feeling. And there's a couple of real crunch points, you know, in the book where we talk about those two parallel lives, you know, the academia on one side and rugby on the other, as almost these two train tracks running in parallel, both of them going roughly the same speed in the same direction, and this constant risk that they might just collide and both things would blow up in his face. And there was a point at which they nearly did. It was 2013, and the week Wales were preparing to face England in that defining game in that championship was also the week he was sitting his final medical exams. And someone like, you know, a mere mortal like myself, I could not get my head around why you would voluntarily put yourself under that much pressure. You know, to do one of those things would probably make most of us go weak at the knees, but to do both of them at the same time is almost perverse. So there were a lot of our conversations where I just had to drill really deep to try and understand, because I can't understand that at surface level, you know. I was almost like an amateur psychologist, you know. Explain to me what it is about the way your brain's wired that you almost invite that kind of pressure. And he does, you know. There's an almost perverse side to his personality where he doesn't feel like he's fully alive unless he's got all this stuff on his plate. And it's almost this delayed gratification thing. If he can see the triumph beyond it, he can focus on that, knowing that it will be worth it when he gets there. So yeah, a lot of that stuff, whereas before I would have just watched that game from a broadcaster's point of view, what an epic match and what a brilliant narrative. Seeing it from his point of view as an individual living every moment was a totally different kind of lens, as you say.
And do you see that, you know, that part, the kind of the psychology, if you like, behind it? Does that then again almost make you reassess him as a player, knowing that was what was going on in his life at that particular moment in time?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, Jamie is one of those guys who was very successful in that era under Warren Gatland. And we thought a lot of them were almost invulnerable to criticism. You know, they were so, the ethos of the team was just this powerful, teak tough side that came and kind of knocked the hinges off the doors. You know, there wasn't much subtlety there, but I suppose we all thought that they were impervious to the slings and arrows of public opinion. But you realize actually, you know, everyone's human. And there were some really dark times in his career where he did feel, you know, the pain and the suffering and stuff. And you realize that this exterior image, you know, this hulking, great, huge bloke actually hides a fairly sensitive center. And I think one of the things we explored to pick up on that point was this notion, you know, that he, when Warren Gatland's game plan got criticized for being too one-dimensional and not imaginative enough, he was almost the focal point of that criticism because he was seen as the linchpin of that game plan. And I think a lot of that criticism was heaped on his shoulders. It was interesting just getting his perspective on how that affected him, you know, personally.
Yeah, that's just a really good point. And I suppose, again, I never thought of that because they're the chats that you have down the pub, you know, and again, as a fan, you tend to look at these things and that from that, you know, from a very, very different perspective, not just because you're not playing, but because you see the game differently. So yeah, it's really interesting to hear it that way. Something that I kind of found very interesting reading about was kind of Warren Gatland's man management methods and how, again, not in a critical way, but Jamie seems to say that, you know, didn't have many deep and meaningful conversations because he knew that Gatland had a way of kind of pulling his strings to get the best out of him in that way.
Yeah, and he'll tell you, you know, that it took him a while to realise that was the case. You know, it's with the benefit of hindsight, you think actually that was quite clever coaching, whereas at the time you might feel you're being spurned or ignored or belittled or whatever it may be. But he had this idea that, you know, Gatland viewed every player as a different entity. So, you know, that player needs to be humiliated sometimes in front of the boys if he's to learn his lessons. Whereas that player, if you do that to him, he'll retreat into a shell and become half the player he's capable of being. So Jamie's thing, you know, and Sean Edwards admitted this to him later on, that they would never publicly praise him because they didn't think that would work with him. You know, it would swell his ego too much. And so they would rather tell him privately what he was doing well, but actually highlight his mistakes to his colleagues to keep his ego in check. And they did that with a lot of players, by all accounts. You know, he wasn't the only one they treated that way. So I think it was a very calculated move on Warren Gatland's behalf. And like you say, it's not necessarily a criticism. It's just an acknowledgement that actually the almost aloof approach he took was deliberate, you know, in order to get the best out of these players. And he almost let some of his lieutenants like Rob Howley or McBride get closer to them on a personal level. He saw his role as the overseer, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
He can tell you himself.
There we go. All right. Well, we'll pause for one moment while Jamie's audio connects.
Evening, guys. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. Sorry, I've been running around like a madman this evening.
No, it's
sorry,
good.
Sorry, I'm a bit late.
No worries at all. Yeah, we've just been chatting about kind of the writing process, and I was saying how there's you know, been plenty of headlines written, but there seems like there's a huge amount of things you kind of wanted to say during this book as well. It's not your standard up and down autobiography. You've got plenty of big rugby issues that you want to talk about. Did you know that when you kind of went to kind of start writing the book, that you wanted to be very, very frank?
Well, I think it's pointless writing a book otherwise, unless you can be honest. I think we've all got different opinions about certain aspects of the game. And, you know, it's been funny, the reaction, actually. You know, I've had half my mates messaging me, and you say, "Oh, mate, love your work, really, really, you know, appreciate your honesty and what have you." And then you've got a couple of fans tweeting you completely disagreeing with you. And I think that's healthy. I think, you know, we can't all agree on everything. But, you know, that's the way I see issues in the game. And it's good to get that down on paper. If it steers some healthy debates, well, then great. Those are just my opinions. If people agree with them, great. If they don't, even, you know, great. It doesn't really matter. I think writing a book is about putting those things out there and being honest about what you think about certain things. So it's been a nice experience to do that. And I hope people enjoy reading the book. It's I guess when you're sitting down with Ross and going to write it, I guess my career isn't your sort of archetypal rugby career. I've travelled quite a bit, obviously studied across the country, and experienced different leagues in the game, obviously representative rugby, different teams, etc. So, you know, it's an amazing experience, some great stories in there, and certainly about, you know, growing up playing rugby in Cardiff, and then getting to play for the British Lions, and you know, my path to achieving that.
Obviously, yeah, you mentioned there a number of different experiences playing abroad. Is there one of those that kind of particularly stands out as one you've enjoyed the most?
That's very difficult. Each has with it pros and cons. I remember when I left Cardiff to move to play in Paris. For the first probably 3 or 4 months, I really struggled. I got injured in one of my early kind of warm-up games. I did my ankle, had an operation which kept me out for 12 weeks. And I was living on my own. I didn't know the language well. And, you know, there were some nights sat in my apartment just thinking, what the hell have I done? You know, I had a great life in Cardiff. I'd grown up there. I'd graduated recently. You know, Cardiff wanted to offer me a contract. And when all the factors were at play, you know, which people are letting down, am I, you know, being unfaithful to my city side, etc. All those things come into your mind when you're making such a decision. And I'm sat there in my flat just thinking, what on earth have I done? And I reflect on it. Certainly it took me, you know, 3-4 months. Then I started to learn the language, you know, good network of people, started enjoying my rugby after, you know, being injured. And by the end of my time there, I reflected on it as the best thing I'd ever done in my life, you know, putting myself out of my comfort zone, leaving my home city. You know, it's crazy to think that I was even contemplating not doing it, because I was very much that way as a kid. It was all about travel, all about taking those experiences. Any opportunity that comes your way in life, I was always the first to say yes. You can always turn it down later. I would say yes to everything. I still do. And it's crazy to even think that I was contemplating not taking that opportunity. You know, 26, as a single guy, got offered a big contract to live in one of the best cities in the world, and I was still in a minor in whether or not to do it. It was crazy. Crazy when I reflect on that decision 9 years ago now. And as I said, best thing I did. So probably Paris. Look, I loved my time at Harlequins and Bath and obviously South Africa for a short period, but that few years in Paris were just amazing, and it's such an awesome city to live in. And I played in a brilliant wrestling side who have gone on to achieve, you know, huge success over recent past. So, you know, to be a part of that, I didn't win any trophies there, but to be a part of that journey with that side and that coaching group was pretty cool.
And yeah, you obviously spoken there about the experience as a, you know, growing as a person as much as the rugby experience. Is that the kind of the crux of the, I guess the reason you disagree with that 60 cap rule is that it's preventing other players from having that opportunity to go and grow as players and as individuals?
Yes, I guess that's the crux of it. And look, on one hand, you've got this opportunity for individuals, you know, out their comfort zones, experiencing new environments, going to experience rugby on the continent. As we said, you know, growing as people, you know, seeing the world. And on the other hand, you've got the argument that they get an extra week's preparation playing in Wales. Let's bear in mind, there's only one game played outside the window each year. So I don't think that argument really stands, because it's only for one game in 1 week of the year when we're talking about this 60 cap rule. But yeah, you know, the big argument is that we get them for an extra week's training. Now, yeah, as I said, on one hand, you've got this exposure to different experiences and lads growing and becoming better people and better players. And then you've got this extra week's training. And, you know, at the minute, more weight is placed on that extra week's training. And it's certainly tilted so far that way that it's like, no, you can't play abroad. We won't have you for this extra week's training. Yes, there's the funding model, etc. And, you know, best players playing in Wales, you know, there's huge arguments for it. But I just think too much weight is placed on the extra week's training because it players back in for 1 week's training before a test match. But players who are wiser to the world, who have experience, you know, we talked about all the factors. I'd argue that's probably more beneficial to Team Wales than that extra week's training itself.
I suppose that, yeah, you've touched on the having the best players play in Wales argument. I suppose that's the other counter argument is, you know, if you were to take a side that you're, you know, that you're playing in right now with the Dragons and, you know, there's a crop of really talented youngsters there at the moment. If they're offered contracts elsewhere, you know, it'd be very, very hard for that for the Dragons to compete if they were elsewhere. You know, I suppose that potentially is the other argument.
With the current rules in England and in France, not many would. And so, you know, signing foreign players, mate, there's not many British players now playing in France because of the GIF rules and also the non-EQP rules that England have in their league. So certainly when I was playing out in France and a whole host of us were playing out in France, you know, Charteris, Jonathan Davis, Mikey Phillips, Gethin Jenkins, these lads, all over the border in England. I mean, it was a handful of players, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 players at most. So, you know, to call that a player drain, I think is probably a bit far. But look, I completely get the counter argument. I'm all for healthy debate on this thing. I'm a big believer that senior players have a huge part to play in passing on that IP to younger players at squads. But also, I guess if senior players aren't there, that provides opportunity for others to play and grow. So. But there's no right or wrong to this argument. It's just the way I see it. It's my opinion, and the other thing that frustrates me is where does the number 60 come from? I mean, who decided that? Like, where is it plucked out of thin air? Who has decided that 60 equals service? I mean, like it's crazy. It doesn't take into account you know you might be sat on the bench for 40 games for Wales and not got on over the course of 7 seasons. And you know, it's such an arbitrary number. And it also doesn't take into account your service to club rugby in Wales.
That was the recent Wes Webb argument, wasn't it? You know, 50 caps, I think, when he left for Toulon, but he'd been with the Ospreys since the academy days.
And we're turning around 10, and 12 saying...
12 years, giving...
Yeah. And because he hasn't got 60 caps, he hasn't done his service to his country. I mean, he can fly back from France in an hour.
Yeah.
It's not difficult. And, you know, he's playing where he's been offered his, you know, a great contract. And he's putting himself out of his comfort zone, playing at clubs he wants to play at. It's difficult. It doesn't sit well with me. I'm glad I've spoken my mind on it. People can disagree until the cows come home, and I respect all angles on the argument, and I think it's just it's a healthy debate, and I just hope there's a bit of manoeuvre in it because I'd love to see young players. I mean, you look at that team from the weekend, and who's playing in England? You look at the Wales team that beat Fiji on the weekend. Dan Biggar's playing in England. Nick Tompkins is playing in England. Johnny Williams plied his trade in Newcastle. You know, I think he became the player who did ply his trade in Newcastle. Lewis Rizam is playing in Gloucester. Liam Williams arguably had his best seasons at club level playing in Saracens. And Alex Cuthbert's just come back from Exeter.
And Tom Young as well.
Well, you take Tom Young. You go through the forwards. Yeah. Chris, who came on to make his debut, is playing in Exeter. Will Rowlands had some top years at Wasps.
Will Griff John, you know,
Tom Francis didn't start, but he's played in Exeter. So, like, it's great. as I said, a lot of these guys have become the players they are and certainly grown their game as players and, you know, grown as people by playing outside of Wales.
Something I found quite interesting is, you know, obviously there's always lots of rugby autobiographies out there. Kind of what made you want to write this now while you're still playing and rather than kind of waiting until you'd finished? Was there something that kind of triggered wanting to kind of relive those experiences?
Well, I think if I waited another year or two, people have forgotten who the hell I am, to be honest. Look, I haven't played for Wales in 4 years. You know, and that ship has probably sailed. Never say never, but it's probably sailed. So, whether I play another year or two, it remains to be seen. But it just felt the time was right to really do it. I didn't want to wait too much longer. And I didn't really want to do it earlier, to be honest. You know, I know lads have written books in the middle of their careers and great. It's just something I didn't really see, you know, benefit in doing. And I'm glad I've written it. It's, you know, it's been a really enjoyable experience. It's quite a cleansing experience, if I can put it that way. Just kind of talking about times in my life and times in my career that I've rarely spoken to people about. You know, I think as blokes, we're quite shy to share emotions, aren't we, around certain things and the tough times and, you know, even the good times. You know, you only speak about them maybe with one or two close people in your life. So to get that all out there and then those emotions I felt at the time, etc., I hope it gives insight to others as to what it's really like as a professional sportsman. You know, I think it's, as a rugby player, you do all these press interviews and they can be quite samey and monotonous. You know, certainly when you're playing Test rugby, it's very difficult to show your true colours. I mean, you're always wary of showing your true colours and being vulnerable. But I think by putting all that on paper, it's been quite a nice experience.
And obviously, you've mentioned, you know, some of the journeys you've been on there, and Ross and I were chatting just before you joined about the kind of that balancing act between. Between your medical studies, between studying at Cambridge and rugby. I mean, we were kind of saying it's a difficult thing for us to get our head around, but how did you find that kind of threat? And obviously it carries on as well, but being able to kind of compartmentalize and, you know, and say, right, this is going on in my medical professional life, this is going on in studying, but I've got to clear my head for all that because I've got to go out and play the All Blacks or play England or whatever it might be.
Yeah, look, I found that the more I really, really kind of obsessed about the game, the worse I played on the weekend. And flip side to that, I've probably come to that conclusion. I think the less I was obsessive about the game, the better I played. So I kind of worked that out quite early in my career. And I just loved having distraction off the pitch. You know, I was very I wanted to be very efficient with my time. You know, when I was at the ground and I was training, it was 100%, but then when I was away from the ground, it was 0%. I wanted nothing to do with rugby when I was away from training. You know, on a day off, maybe in the evenings, you know, I'd make sure I was there, I was at full tilt, but then I just wanted to escape. I very rarely on my days off, you know, certainly the peak of my career, I'd want to hang around with the rugby lads. I'd want to completely escape that environment. And work the mind. I guess rugby is very physically demanding. You've talked about kind of compartmentalising. My challenge was to differentiate between kind of mental and physical fatigue. So, you know, I found after training, I was very kind of physically fatigued, but mentally I wasn't really. And then being able to study or go to lectures or, you know, tutorials, etc., I could work my mind, but ultimately in most of those situations I was sat in a chair or stood still and you know, I was working my mind, but it wasn't physically taxing. And so that yin and yang to my life, I guess, I could escape rugby on a Tuesday after training and I could come back to it Thursday morning after the day off just completely new to it. It gave me kind of extra enthusiasm because I hadn't even considered it for a day and a half. And just doing that over time. You know, rugby, you know, for anyone listening or kind of reading a book, just get an idea. Rugby can be very monotonous as a career. There's no doubt about that. If you've, you know, if you are a bit of a thinker or whatever, it can be quite monotonous. You know, it's the same weights every day, every week. You know, you're just playing a different team on the weekend. You know, certainly for me, I would have been proper bored if I didn't have something away from the game. And again, I worked that out quite early in my life. You know, I went straight to uni at 18, but I guess I've never known any different. And certainly now I've finished uni and I've got a kid now, which keeps me busy enough. But it's it was my escape. It was my escape from the game. And, you know, I think it's important to say that everyone's different. Everyone has their own way of peaking for that 80 minutes on the weekend, you know, because ultimately that's all it's about.
The chapter in the book, I think, I was going to say the most crystallizes that whole thing. Jamie and I talked about this a lot, the Barbarians thing, and how that was almost your kind of epiphany, where you saw all those world-class players who'd been on the piss all week and trained terribly, could barely catch a ball, and all of a sudden on the Saturday when they play the All Blacks, they flicked the switch and they went out and won. You all went out and won. And I speak to you about that, and it occurred to me that that almost applies to any profession. You know, you can overthink everything, can't you? You can be so wrapped up in what, if you've got a job to do on the weekend, whether it's professional sport or mock broadcasting in my case, you can overthink it to the degree that it becomes your sole focus. Everything becomes too regimented, too thought through, and you lose that looseness that you perhaps need to pull it off. And I really enjoyed those conversations about the Barbarians, because it was almost as though that was the moment you thought, actually, a lot of the knowledge is there. It's muscle memory. As long as I tap into it on the day and I've done enough prep, I can forget about it in the lead up to these games.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, Ross. I guess I'd grown up in the academy system. It was all about kind of preparation. You know, have you done all your reps? Have you done all your sets? Have you got your recovery right? Have you got all your analysis done? Have you done everything possible in the week to be the best player at the weekend? Now, what happens then is I've played with some lads and I've been in squads. People assume if you do all that in the weekend, you're going to play well in the 80 minutes on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And it doesn't translate like that. It doesn't work like that, professional sport. You know, it's, yes, you give yourself the best opportunity, but you still have to deliver for that 80 minutes of the weekend and be at your peak arousal level, I guess. And again, everyone has different ways of kind of finding their best performance and preparing for that best performance. But that 2009 episode kind of tilted my perspective on preparation, etc., in the week on its head, really. Probably obviously through a biased lens, because I've been through that week and enjoyed that success of the Barbarians. But look, I've been very professional in my career, but I never fell into the trap of assuming that if I did all those things in the week that I'd play well on the weekend. And I, you know, I've played with lads who have been like that. They've been fantastic in the week. They do all the work, brilliant, and then they just don't deliver on a Saturday. You know, they're not always correlated. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was all about the Saturday 80 minutes for me, regardless of what I'd done in the week. You know, if I missed a few things, it didn't really bother me. You know, I never felt that, you know, if I hadn't done a bit of recovery, or I don't know, I haven't slept as well, or maybe missed a meal or what have you, that I'd be like, oh God, I'm going to play terrible on the weekend now because whatever. Is I put so much weight to just being in that right state of arousal come that 18 minutes and delivering in that 18 minutes.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. The interesting, or one of the interesting things you touched on there and read it in the book as well, is that phrase you use, kind of, you know, rugby's a monotonous existence. Do you kind of, as you're kind of coming towards the end of your career, what relationship do you have with rugby? Is it, you know, is it still just a very professional one, or do you feel like, you know, there's, I guess, a bit of that element of being a fan or a kid that's still in there?
Yeah, a bit of both. Look, I think ultimately relationships with people form the foundation of the sport, don't they? You know, you speak to loads of players who have finished, they'll never remember how many jackals they won back in 2014. They'll remember the night out. Or they remember the relationships they carry forward from playing the game. So, you know, I am very conscious that, you know, our time in the game is all finite as players. It's going to finish at some point. And the things that I cherish most are those relationships with people that I've, you know, enjoyed the field with or enjoyed the bar with. So that's important. And look, I'm just competitive. I love the game because it's competitive. I hate doing drills in rugby training that aren't. I get wound up if there's no element of competition in it. It forms a foundation of the sport and what we're all about. So, you know, the minute I cease to be competitive or I can't perform at the level which allows me to be competitive, I'll hang up my boots. That will be, I think, my love for the game will drop out his backside, really. I think it's what I'm all about. I want to win. I want to compete against my fellow teammates for the jersey or my position who I'm playing against. So, you know, I'm still hungry in that respect. And that's all that matters. Everything else is secondary.
Talking about stuff away from the game, it's something that crossed my mind as we had this interview lined up was, how did you two manage to actually get around to writing a rugby book and not sit there talking about music all the time, given your respective passions in that area as well?
Ross is far more knowledgeable about music than me. I'm just a blagger, really. I guess my musical taste is born out of family holidays. And look, we travelled up and down the country as a family, hosteling here, there and everywhere. You know, we were two young lads. Best way to do it, I think, you know, my parents certainly thought it was, and just the music in the car. It was always Pink Floyd, Fleetwood Mac, Beautiful South, all these bands. So, you know, I turned on that music now. Isn't the way you remember lyrics is just crazy in the brain, isn't it? So I know all the lyrics to all these songs. It's berserk. But yeah, Ross is far more musically educated than me, no doubt. But we have chewed the fat many times writing the book.
Go and get the guitar. We had a good road trip the other day, actually, to one of our events. We had a bit of a Stone Roses deep dive and opened up that perennial debate about whether the Second Coming got a hard press when it came out. Five years after they released that seminal debut, all their fans were desperate for the sequel, and Second Coming came out to a pretty lukewarm response. But I maintain, and I discovered that Jamie's of the same opinion, during our road trip the other day, that Second Coming is a bona fide classic, and I'll hear nothing said against it.
Look, I don't think we've got time to get into the Second Coming debate right now. You're a child of the 90s,
Jed. You've surely got an opinion on that.
Look, I'd certainly be with you that it had a hard time. And it's whether or not it's a bona fide classic album, I think it got an unfair hard rap, and there's a lot of good stuff on there. But you know, how do you follow that debut? You know, you can't. It adds to the mystique, the fact that they couldn't. That's the beauty of it. Is it kind of it takes 20 years to go back and revisit the album before you can kind of go, actually, yeah, this is great.
Well, as we discussed the other day, if Ian Brown was good looking and he could sing, they'd have been an even better band.
That's it. Exactly. Look, it's been fantastic to chat to you both. And Jamie, as I was saying to Ross, you may or may not remember, we had a very brief chat at Quinn's training ground a few years ago, and the audio failed to work for me. So I'm hoping we don't.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I know. I was listeners to this podcast know this story well, but yeah, I was deep in the midst of editing the podcast at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night. And that's when I discovered that the audio hadn't worked. But there we go. So it's fine. It's good to 3 years later to kind of correct that. But yeah, best of luck with the book. It doesn't seem like you need it because it's certainly got plenty of coverage already. And most importantly, best of the luck with the rest of the season for the Dragons.
So, man, thank you very much, mate.
And Ross, always a pleasure to have you on board. Really appreciate your time.
Pleasure, Jed. All the best, mate. Take care.
Cheers, gents. Set up.
Social Podcast Network.